Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
To introduce to you all, Vicky Austin, who has been an integral part of Zen practice in the Bay Area for 50 years. Vicky is started her practice over 50 years ago. She is a Dharma teacher in San Francisco Zen Center. And in addition, she is a well-known and she's a certified yoga teacher with an international reputation. She is a Dharma heir of Suzuki Roshi and well-known internationally as a priest of the Soto School and as a well-respected teacher and from San Francisco Zen Center and has been our good friend for many years. So Vicky, I want to thank you for being with us tonight, for taking time out to share your experience and your wisdom with us. I look forward to your talk tonight.
Thanks, Les.
Do you have a title for your talk tonight, Vicky?
Why don't we call it Return to Sangha?
Thank you.
Okay. And thank you, everybody, for being here. Thank you, Les, for inviting me. I feel very honored. And yes, I did start practice a really long time ago when I was about 18 years old for very good reasons. And I hope that I've actually fulfilled some of the deep needs and wishes that brought me to practice. And I know that I haven't, although I've been working on it for a very long time, for most of my life. I haven't done it yet. Or should I say that it's a moving target, and no matter what I do, there's more to do to actually relieve suffering for myself, for my family, for the people around me, for the people I know, for the people I don't know, for the world. And looking around at the people in this Zoom room, I see a group of very talented, accomplished, and human folks who are doing amazingly wonderful things to help people in the world. Not because you have to, but because you really want to. And not only are you doing those things, but you're skilled in doing those things. So I know several of the people in the room, and I know what level of skill that you have. And what I think is that all of our skills and all of our wishes combine to form one sangha this evening. And there's a phrase in the Book of Serenity, Case 4, which is called "The World Honored One Points to the Ground." The very last sentence of the commentary for that case is, "A community for a day, abiding forever." A community for a day, abiding forever. So I don't want to make a whole kind of fussy commentary on the case. I'm just very interested in this concept of a community for a day abiding forever. And what does it mean to establish and take refuge in Sangha just for today? Why is it important, and why is it particularly important now? And how can we, as talented, skilled people who have just been through the traumatic experience of pandemic and are re-entering our lives together. How can we work with what the Sangha is and what it particularly can bring to our lives and the lives of those around us? So this is a question from the bottom of my heart.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you, Les, for even just pointing me in this direction. So what Les said, I wrote to you. I hope you don't mind if I reveal the contents of our correspondence, our email. So Les had invited me to speak, and I asked, well, what's important at Kanando right now? You know, Kanon is Avalokiteshvara, sometimes known as the sound observer, sometimes the hearer of the cries of the world. And Do is a place of practice, a way of practice. And so Kanon Do is to hear the cries of the world and to make a route through the cries and suffering of the world to respond. Of course, we can do this in so many different ways. We can do it as mathematicians, as engineers, as physicists, as user experience people, as chaplain, as researchers, and so on, you know, as philanthropists, as teachers, as priests, and so on. There's no limit to what we can do ourselves. I mean, what I should say is the limits are not set by the limits of by the potential of the work. The limits are set by how many hours are in the day, whether we have families, what we need to eat and put a roof over our head, and so on. So there are limits, but the potential is unlimited for response. And how does Sangha actually help us with this? So I asked Les what's important, and he said, due to COVID, the popularity of Zoom, and a number of longtime members moving out of state because of work and family issues, in-person attendance at Kanon Do has diminished in the past few years. It's also a pandemic. We're looking at how to re-energize the Sangha in the current environment. So what I want to say is the tools are here. There's creativity, there's skill, there's, if you look around at the people and the names in the Zoom room, you'll see that, we have a variety of names from a variety of possible backgrounds. And altogether, I think this room, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, just the combinations of us are like 15 times 14 times 13 times 12, etc. Not to mention all the connections of all the people we know and all the principled people we know who support our practice. So let's just look in an ordinary way, in a humble way, at what Sangha can do. Let's just say that we're all working and living and re-entering the world after the social isolation of the pandemic. And just in a very mundane way, a Sangha is a group of people who can support our deepest intentions through the medium of body, through the medium of speech, through the medium of mind. I notice also a nonviolent communication practitioner in this room, at least one, for instance, or two. A Sangha can help. The people in the Sangha can be interested in whether we're sick or well. Can send us food if we're sick, for instance, can accompany us if we need something, like if we get a diagnosis and need to go to the doctor. And a Sangha can carpool. We can know whether we're coming to sit zazen together, and we can carpool. And these are just very basic, mundane things that we can do together that give a feeling of connection that we haven't been able to do for 2.5 years. very much. We haven't been able to carpool. We haven't been able to visit sick people necessarily. We haven't been able to accompany people to their doctor's appointments or to the hospital. We haven't been able to have a somatic impact on the other people in this Zoom room. So we're very dependent on sight and sound, but we're not really using yet. We need to use our ability to speak to each other with our bodies, with our actions, and so on. And I'm not saying that Zoom is bad or that the tech that we've been depending on for 2.5 years is bad. It's good, actually. It's great. I mean, it allowed us to stay together. And we can do even more with it. For instance, we could use our tech savvy to empower the people who are far flung in this Sangha, in the decision making and direction of the Sangha. We could use it, I see a researcher in this room. We could research using the tech savvy that we have to find out where the people who were historically members of Kanando are now, and how the building and in-person practice can to support people who have been here in the past. Like if they live in Arizona or North Carolina or something, would they be interested in coming every 3 months or twice a year or for special occasions? So again, this is a very mundane kind of response to a very non-mundane question. But so tech is good, not just because it's helped us connect, but also tech has the potential to be good, not just because it's helped us connect, but also because it gives us the means to be curious about each other, to connect with each other, to find out each other's needs and be able to respond in convenient ways. So we actually have more potential to look at what Zoom and other technologies can do for us. So I'm sure that there's people here who don't actually live in Mountain View who wouldn't be able to drive to come to lecture tonight, who are here because of Zoom. But what might be the unique contributions of being in person with each other that we haven't been able to benefit from and may have, in fact, forgotten? Those benefits may have receded for us. The first is that, of course, that Sangha is not just a group of people sitting in a room together. Sangha is a refuge. Sangha is part of our vow. Sangha is part of our truth. Sangha is part of our skillful means to wake up for the benefit of all beings, not just a couple or some. So let's say that the Sangha only has 8 people who can show up in person. What can 8 people do? Or 6 people, or 4 people, or even 3 people, or 5? Well, the Buddha said 5 is a Sangha. So he gave a list of 6 concords that I won't go into right now, but they're basically sharing particular resources and insights for practice with each other. And the Buddha said, and there's a list of them, the Buddha said, as long as people do these things or have these 6 concords, the Sangha will prosper. As long as we take the time, the effort, and the appreciation to build these concords, the Sangha will thrive. But uniquely, what can a small group of people do that a larger group of people cannot? What are the benefits of this time? So I want to say that, first of all, the physical presence of being in a room sitting zazen with other people is it helps us understand the meaning of refuge just by being with dignified deportment, sitting upright, with perfect attention on posture and breathing, and great pure effort, each person doing that alone together instead of alone, gives us a sense of the beauty and power of refuge and of practice, just to be with people in that way. Small group, the small size of a group, allows us to focus on intimacy, allows us to focus on the person rather than the schedule, rather than the correctness or incorrectness of the form, rather than the mechanics of putting together a program or the need for donations. So we can actually focus on who we are, be curious about each other. We can focus on the ordinary sides of the ordinary side of life with each other as a refuge practice. We can celebrate with each other any joy that comes up, and we can grieve the pain and the suffering that comes up. We can honor each other's home life, each other's families, what's important to each other in ways that are difficult to find or do in very big groups of people. What I'm saying is that Sangha, one of the things that a small Sangha can do is to establish simple connections between and among each other as good spiritual friends. And we can redevelop or rebuild our routine for zazen in humble ways that make sense to us at a somatic level. So I just wanted to say that because I don't know if you remember what it's like to cook with other people. I don't know if we remember what it's like to sit with other people, to do kinhin, to walk, to eat orioki just enough, to make offerings with other people, you know, to clean the temple, fluff up the zafus and stuff. I don't know if we remember what that's like. And so these very simple ways of being with each other give us a sense of what's good in the world, what's satisfying and peaceful in the world. It's actually one of the most radical political acts that we can do, is to be ourselves with each other in simple, humble, and peaceful ways like this. But you know, a lot of people don't feel safe about coming back in person. So San Francisco Zen Center reopened its doors yesterday. Here in San Francisco, one of the biggest zendos in the country. And I was in the kitchen. I have to wear a mask because I just came back from meeting my niece's new baby in LA. So I was traveling, so I had to wear a mask. And I was talking with people while socially isolating about meals, and about people were talking about Iranian food. So somebody wanted to make a Persian dish with herbs and didn't know how to do a vegetarian version of it. So I made some suggestions for vegetarian protein because I was the Tenzo, the head cook at San Francisco Zen Center for 3 years, and it was a very important thing for me. And I said, if you want, I can help you figure out a bounce if you want to make this dish. And this person said, how many people did you used to cook for? And I said, 60 to 120. And, you know, his jaw fell down. He said, oh, we're cooking for like 15 to 30 people now. And there were about that many, there were about 15 people in the Zendo this morning. And I was talking with some of the people and saying, well, you can come back now. And they were saying, well, I don't know. I don't know, because maybe people won't be masked and, you know, like it's a commute and stuff. They didn't feel safe. So that got me thinking about, I wonder whether the Sangha might need to make some changes to help members make a transition to coming in person. I wonder what changes might actually help people come back. Because of course we could just keep sitting Zazen and wait, but I kind of feel at this point like my life isn't that long. I don't have another 50 years to sit around and wait for people to come and sit Zazen, even though that's probably like the ideal practice of equanimity, you know, whether one person comes or whether 50 people come, I don't care. I would be a very good Zen person if I actually felt that way. However, I don't. I'm more thinking, well, what would it take to get people to come back? Because this is a really good thing to do. It's a refuge that I have a commitment to offer in this life. And so I was thinking, well, maybe one thing I could do would be to see if other people might be interested, other teachers might be interested in helping me to recognize, to acknowledge, and to support the suffering that they've been through, that they've been exposed to. Illness, trauma, social isolation, the disruption of all their routines, the inability to actually visit family and friends and so on. Perhaps I might be able to create a forum for their stories and feelings to be heard. That might be a good thing to do as a transitional practice. And then I also thought, I wonder whether the usual schedule of two periods of Zazen service and Soji, temple cleaning, might be intimidating. They might have gotten used to other routines. That might be too many things in the morning before they go back to the work that they also haven't been to in person for 2.5 years. So I wonder whether there might be a way to break it down into small, friendly, manageable occasions to make it okay somehow in the Sangha if you didn't attend for 2.5 hours, but if you attended for 45 minutes. I wonder whether that would be okay. And then I also thought, well, I don't really have the right to decide what's safe for them. What if I actually was curious about it and asked, what would make you feel safe? What if I helped the Sangha understand what it would be like if it were safe? What do I need to know about them that I don't know? Each person, there isn't a them, so each person, what do I need to know about that person that I don't know to allow that person to feel safe, to allow the group to feel safe? What do they need? So then I thought, well, I don't really have answers to this. What's fundamental about Sangha? What do I need to concentrate or focus on to give shape to my choices with this question of how to bring people back in person? What's important about it? Then I thought, okay, why don't I go back to that statement? A Sangha is a refuge. You take refuge once, you take refuge once, you take refuge once, you take refuge once, you keep taking refuge once. You can't kind of continuously take refuge or developmentally take refuge solely, although your ability to take and give refuge does increase over time. We take refuge now. Now is when we take refuge. Thich Nhat Hanh taught that a Sangha is a community of friends practicing the Dharma together in order to bring about and to maintain awareness. The essence of Sangha is awareness, understanding, acceptance, harmony, and love. And we have that teaching in a, if you want to look at the Zen, Soto Zen version of that teaching, it's in the Kyoju Kaimon. We receive the refuges, the pure precepts, and the clear mind precepts in three different ways. We receive them ultimately. The ultimate nature of Sangha is harmony. The manifested nature of Sangha is people and things and a space to practice. And the maintained nature of Sangha is whatever comes up in studying our life together is the true body of the Sangha. So there's three different ways to approach Sangha practice in our tradition, and they correspond to to a very kind of ultimate and mystical sense of what Sangha might be. It's a kind of dharmakaya, a dharma body, or a great body of Sangha is one way to understand it meditatively. Another meditative way to understand it is humbly, just as each of us together. And the third way is functionally, to understand how we interact together with the various issues and problems that come up, like this one. So the important things about Sangha is that it's rooted in vow. It's rooted in a vow that's deeper than any suffering and helps us make our way through suffering. That the treasure of Sangha, the treasure store of Sangha, is the is peaceful environment like Kanando or like San Francisco Zen Center. That it creates an environment in which peace and understanding can be nurtured, in which there are supportive treasures that can be brought up, like teachers and like books and like beautiful gardens and serene, clean space, in which our awakening mind can be supported and nourished. And then also we can, the whole is really greater than the sum of its parts, that we can use Sangha to actively train ourselves and practice skillful means that are appropriate for re-entry, such as the reconciliation of differences or a feeling of unsafety, such as working together for a common goal, such as learning how to work with equanimity. We can do those practices together. So I'd like to just close this musing on returning to Sangha with the case that I mentioned earlier, and just read you the case. It's very poetic and it's not long. So in the introduction to the case, we hear that as soon as a single mote of dust arises, the whole world comes up for our consideration. With a single horse and a single spear, the whole country is extended. Who is the person who can be master in any place and meet the source in everything? And I would add, who is the person who can support others to be master in any place and to meet the source in everything? This is the case. So the Buddha, the world honored one, was walking with the Sangha. And he pointed to the ground with his finger and said, "This spot is good to build a monastery." So Indra, the emperor of the gods, took a blade of grass, stuck it back in the ground, and said, "The sanctuary is built." And the world honored one smiled. That's the whole case. plug, the sanctuary is built. Smile. Okay. And so the sanctuary is built now with this blade of grass. The entire Sangha comes into being with each other. We're not going to do it perfectly. We are going to make mistakes. We are going to do this together because it's our vow. And we'll do it with each other as who we really are, and what we really need, what we really want, how we really can work together. And I promise I'll support you. And I request that you support me and each other. Thank you. Okay, so I probably raised a whole lot more questions than I answered. I'm sorry. But Les, is this the time when we would actually speak about this, like unmute ourselves and stuff?
If you have a question for Vicky, now would be the time to bring it forward.
And I'm also interested in your comments and your experience and your wisdom and your reflections.
I just wanted to say thank you so much for giving your thoughts on this topic. It has been so different these last several months for those of us who are, you know, still living in the area and still able to come to Canando. And also because our teacher Les has been, you know, has had some health problems too over the past couple of years. And now we're just overjoyed that he's able to come back and sit in the morning with us, and you know, when he can, he's there again, and that just makes so much difference to those of us who, you know, who are coming to sit at Canando. So, but I appreciate your perspective, because I realize that even though there may only be, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 people sitting in the early sitting, it still is. And even if we don't know a couple of those people, they're just random people who've come in and said, oh, I think I'll see what this practice is about or what this place is about. It still feels like, you know, we can talk to those people. We can find out about their lives. You know, we can offer a kind listening ear to the problems that they may have, or, you know, whatever it is. So, yes, it's sometimes kind of difficult that we don't have, you know, a full, robust number of people coming in to sit with us, but it still is precious. So thank you for pointing that out to me.
But I'm remembering when San Francisco Zen Center went through its apocalypse in 1983. I had just come back to San Francisco to, I came back immediately afterwards to be the work leader, but also to be trained as an Iyengar yoga teacher, because I wanted to make our meditation instruction more inclusive of physical variety, functional variety. And so I moved back, and almost immediately, there were only 11 people living in the building, in a building that had space for 70. And I remember we rented the building out to a Nikon therapist so that she could do a retreat there and have like 2 people, one in each closet, doing their review of their past lives and speaking to her in the rooms. And we rented it out in various ways to guests, and eventually there were more people again than the building could hold, with a very long waiting list and so on. So there are waves in Sangha. Sangha is affected by circumstances. Circumstances are karma, but we can understand that it's not just karma, it's krama. So karma and krama have the same root. That root is kri. It means to do, to act. But karma is the lawful the lawful universe of action, activity and result. And krama is the steps and stages or the progressive or developmental nature of action. And so if we do these very simple practices, of staying with who we are and being true to our vow instead of becoming desperate and dislocating ourselves from our vow. If we stay true to our vow, there'll be another phase. That's all we can do. And it's a good thing to do. And it's also a time when you can really get to know your teacher. You know, you can really get to know each other. I'm not suggesting that everybody kind of jump on Les and bother him and stuff, but this is a time when your curiosity about your teacher, it can be very fruitful. You can find out more because there's fewer people to ask questions. You know? And that's one thing that you can do in a Sangha live in person. It's very hard to do by yourself at home. You can garden, you can bring food, you can do errands, you can just drop by and make the place your spiritual home in some way. So anyway, thank you, Lee.
Someone recently referred to Kanan Do as a welcoming gathering place. And we were talking about the fact that when we first came to Rock Street, the neighbors were up in arms. They didn't want us there. We don't want those people here. And now the neighbors actually come and use our parking lot and walk in our garden and love the place. So we've been talking about having like an open house for the neighbors and for the neighborhood. I think that would be something that would energize. And also, I'm not sure that the people who are not coming, I don't know if they realize that we are still wearing masks and that we have totally redone our air circulation. So it's actually safer than most people think. And maybe we need to let more people know that. And thank you for your suggestions and your perspective. I really appreciate that. And I'm also curious about your yoga practice. There are people in our Sangha who have expressed interest in yoga practice, but I don't quite know how that would fit in with our practice.
Well, thank you for asking about yoga practice. I have about 40 years of material to respond to that question with, but I'm not going to bore you with that much detail. I just want to say that when Siddhartha Gautama left home to seek enlightenment about the human condition, the first person he went to was Alara the Kalama, who was the top yoga teacher of his time. And after he studied with Alara and discovered and mastered everything that was being taught at that particular ashram, he was invited to stay and teach there, but he didn't feel satisfied about his insight, which he had become, he had mastered a state which was neither perception nor non-perception. So he had mastered a certain type of concentration, and he felt that concentration was great, but as soon as you stopped doing it, everything would come back to haunt you again. So he thought, my work is not done. I really need to understand and address suffering. And then he went to study with another yoga teacher named Rama. But he got to Rama's place and Rama had passed away. So he didn't get to study with him. But Udaka, Rama's son, was teaching. And so he went and studied with him. And then when Prince Gautama had mastered everything that Udaka had to offer, he said, I've done this, and is there anything more that your father had to teach? And Udaka goes, I don't think so. And anyway, the Buddha studied with yoga teachers, and if Alara had not died in between, as soon as he was enlightened, he had the intention to go back and tell his yoga teacher what he had learned. And if he had been able to do that, I think that perhaps the schools wouldn't have split off in the same way. So we don't know what would have happened. Zen is supposed to be the yogic arm of Buddhist practice. So the word Zen comes from Channa, which comes from Dhyana, which means one-pointed concentration with compassionate concern on a meditative subject. And so we're supposed to understand the relationship between deportment and concentration, between physical and physiological, intellectual, psychological, spiritual, and fundamental practice. That's part of what we're supposed to do. But what I found out was that in my first 10 or 12 years of Zen practice, that I had received a type of instruction that led me to actually overdo in meditation and to overvalue insight at the expense of nourishment and simple meditative practice. So I decided I would focus on that. And I made it part of my ordination vow because I thought, I'm not going to get ordained unless I can be sure that I'm not going to hurt anyone if I teach them. So I went and studied with BKS Iyengar for a long time. And at first, both traditions were really upset with me. And then over time, that changed. And so one of the things that I did was to teach yoga for sitters, which I've done, you know, once or twice a week for 35 years, the main idea of it is that whatever problem you have in Zazen is a Dharma gate that we can use, not just in some general, you know, feel good kind of way, but specific study of the truth and breadth and depth of the teaching. So if somebody has a knee problem and continues to hurt it, even if it's unintentional, they have to explore what is the danger that they're putting themselves into and how are they hurting their knee. That's actually a pure precept. We stop over attaching to specific results, and instead we build wholesome action. So I think that they're completely related, and the fact that they're philosophically opposite doesn't really bother me very much, although it used to, because what I found is that the places in which the Hindu understanding of yoga and the Buddhist understanding of Zen, the places where they really contradict are so vast or so deep that words they're not really adequate to describe that particular portion of practice. And so what I've agreed to myself to do is to hold those views with those traditions as provisional. Just like there are different mathematics for different situations, so you wouldn't use Euclidean geometry to study the properties of knots or volumes in space, right? You wouldn't use English to study the 40 or 50 Inuit concepts of snow. Why would you use only one language to study something that's either infinitely great or infinitely small? You know, so it's just a question for me. So I have a responsibility. I have vows to teach Zen, to not let it be cut off. I have a personal sense of responsibility to Suzuki Roshi and to my transmission teacher, Sojin Mel Weitzman, Les's Dharma brother. I have that responsibility, so I'm not going to violate that responsibility. But also, if I put the blinders on and hate other points of view, then I'm only really practically using practice to help a few people and not everybody. So anyway, thank you for that question. I think it's a really important question, Diane, that I could really talk to you about it for a very long time. And I'd like to hear what you have to think, what you think about it as well.
Thank you. Lots to digest.
Hi, Victoria. Thank you for your talk tonight. I wanted to say that a few years ago, I went to Seishin, Rohatsu Seishin at San Francisco Zen Center, and we had a yoga practice with you every day, and it was very supportive. It really helped me to survive the Seishin. So thank you. And I love the stories also that you shared at the time about how you started your yoga practice. I wanted to ask you about the story that you share about the blade of grass and that being a temple. It's a beautiful story. And I was wondering if you could tell a little bit more about what the story means to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Teresa. Thanks for that question. So yeah, it's an important story for me because it's just, first of all, the part of the story that isn't in the story is important to me. Like, why was or how was it that the Buddha happened to be walking around with the Sangha, and what was that like? So, you know, one of my favorite things to do with Mel was to walk the dog with him. So Sojin, my teacher Sojin, you know, he's had a lot of imperfections, and he also one of his wonderful qualities is that he used to take rescue dogs that were very scared of everyone and turn them into good dogs by loving them. And so he would have these very, and actually I got one of my cars because one of his rescue dogs, Bravo, was a very charming little puppy, became so large that Bravo wouldn't fit into the back of Mel and Liz's car. Bravo's back would squinch up against the roof of the car, and he was very uncomfortable. So Mel and Liz sold that car to me and bought a bigger car so that Bravo would have room. This is one of my favorite things about Mel. And so we would go and walk the dog, and the dog would be very attentive to him. And we would just enjoy walking around. And then every so often we would meet somebody, and Mel just looked like anybody. He was wearing this like grungy old hat and grungy old jacket, and he just looked like anybody. And, you know, they would ask him a question. He'd make some deep comment that sounded like nothing. And so I was thinking about that feeling of just walking around doing nothing, but walking with the dog or walking with a friend, and thinking that that is really loving kindness, that very simple feeling in which we just enjoy each other's company and appreciate our lives together. That is metta. That's the essence of metta. And the steps of the four immeasurables, metta, karuna, mudita, and upeksha, all depend on metta. So they're all of the character of loving kindness. So karuna, or compassion, is loving kindness in states of pain or suffering. And mudita, or sympathetic joy, is loving kindness in the midst of celebration on behalf of another person. And equanimity, which we usually think of as a practice, is actually a fruit of sincere practice of loving kindness in every situation. And so what I was thinking was, the Buddha was just walking around and enjoying walking with the assembly. And so there were lots of blades of grass. Lots of blades of grass everywhere. And so when the Buddha said, this spot is good to build a monastery, he was just looking at the landscape and noticing the beautiful qualities of the landscape and reflecting on how nice it would be to sit and meditate under those particular trees. And Indra picked up any old blade of grass, stuck it back in the ground, and said, the sanctuary is built, which means to me that the walk, just as it was holy, was whole. It didn't need anything else. Blade of grass, it kind of reminds me of, you know, G. Spencer Brown's book, Laws of Form. There's this book written in by this guy, G. Spencer Brown, who was a mathematician, but he was also a philosopher, and he was also a spiritual practitioner who loved the Tao Te Ching, you know, and he was like kind of a person of all trades. And so the foreword to this book, which is supposed to be a kind of synthesis that allows us to understand various sorts of math and science, the frontispiece is the Chinese for the very beginning of the Tao Te Ching. The Tao that can be named is not the true Tao. And but his the thesis of the book, there's various sorts of introductory assumptions and stuff like that. And then he makes up a new sign that's this, this, like this little square, just like we would. And the meaning of that sign is, first, draw a distinction. And he said that was the basis of all mathematics, of all science, of all, you know, all the, you know, various sorts of intellectual discipline, language and philosophy and so on. And so the only function of that blade of grass was to draw a distinction between not built and built. And I think if Indra could have gotten away with picking up an atom, he would have. Well, why Indra? Who is Indra? So Indra is the ruler of the gods. Indra is the ruler of, and the word Indra is also used in various ways in Buddhism to talk about the kind of phenomena of human life that dominate our ability to experience. So Buddhism is a study of experience and how we can train our experience to to be small or large, visible or invisible, born or to be born, any kind of way, that we can be equally at home no matter how it is. And to mature our experience, so it's really for everyone's welfare. And so it's a very subtle thing that Indra did. And the Indriyas, Indra is not just, that root is not just for a name. Indriyas are the parts of our experience that rule our ability to perceive, to be motivated, to act, to suffer or not. And so that it was Indra is really interesting and important. Anyway, I just wanted to say that. So thank you for that question. I appreciate it very much. How are we doing on time, by the way? Someone must be keeping time.
I have a question.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your Dharma. Thank you so much for your Dharma. And I'd like to hear a little more about how you understand Zen and yoga to be different mathematics for describing different things.
Yeah, different. I'm not saying different mathematics. I'm saying different logics or different philosophies. So, you know, okay, the easiest way to understand it is there self or is there no self? One of the easiest things. Oh, for Wako, is it okay if I out you as a scholar?
Sure.
Okay, so Wako is a scholar of Buddhism and of how East Asian thought has come to the West over a period of many years. And so this is not just some random question. Okay, so what I'm saying is the calculus of self or no self, that in which the question itself disappears in the realm in which the question is formed, is a very interesting one to me. So as soon as we get deep into meditation and ask self or no self, the whole thing about meditation flip-flops in very kind of uncomfortable but interesting ways. If you're interested in the self and if you understand there's a self, you can see a self and it's luminous and wonderful and all-encompassing and that small one reflects the big one and it's great, it's meaningful and vibrant and alive. If you're in a situation in which you understand there to be no self, then you see no self. And you see that emptiness is actually fullness or possibility, and that when you see no self, that you can see that everything's changing and that's where the life actually is. But if you've studied both of those experientially, it flip-flops. And you realize that neither of those descriptions actually describes the situation. That descriptions themselves are too granular to take care of adequately mirroring or representing what really is there. So it's nuts. It's nuts. You know, it doesn't work. So anyway, it's just another way to come across, to work with the basic unmanageability of life, which the Buddha represented as the first noble truth. And I'd like to represent it from a Long Island point of view as there's always something, you know, there's always something. Okay, so thank you. Thanks for that question. And I really have to ask how we're doing on time because I haven't been keeping track. And somebody is supposed to. There's actually a time limit to this.
Yeah, we're about at our limit now.
Okay. So.
Well, then I just have to say thank you not only for your Dharma, but for your Midrash and for your Talmudic.
That's funny. Yeah. So thanks. What are we supposed to do now? Could somebody, Diane, could you please guide us?
Well, we will end with the Bodhisattva vows.
Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha's way is unsurpassed. I vow to realize it.
Thank you, Vicky. Thank you for being with us tonight and for sharing your experience and your wisdom. Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Kanando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to kanando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.